Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest this week is Dr. John Pyatt. Dr. Pyatt is the senior scientist. He works on seabird and forage fish ecology. And he's with the USGS Alaska Science Center in Anchorage, but I also happen to know that he is a Port Townsend resident. He will be giving the next lecture in the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Ocean series, and that's this coming Sunday on March the 14th. And his title of his talk is What Can Puffins Tell Us About the Impact of Climate Change on Marine Ecosystems. So welcome, John.
Thank you.
The first thing we're going to do is play this week's mystery sound. Well, that was a fun little sound, and I'm not going to give you any hints on that one. But we'll come back to it and identify it a little later. Just a comment about sort of observation and news. In my mind, the news right now is spring is coming. The weather is warming. I hope you all are keeping lookouts for spring migrant birds. And I was so excited this week that I actually saw my first rufous hummingbird of the year. So that's always a good sign. Well, now to our conversation with John Pyatt. As I mentioned earlier, he's a senior scientist and seabird and forage fish ecology program leader with the U.S. Geological Survey Alaska Science Center in Anchorage, Alaska. And Dr. Pyatt has worked in the Arctic for 34 years, studying seabirds and marine food webs. His current research focuses on the role of ocean climate on the abundance and quality of forage fish that support seabird populations. John, what initially got you interested in seabirds and puffins?
My parents, they have a mixed marriage. One is American and one is Canadian. My mother's from Newfoundland and my father was from Texas. And they met in Greenland. And I was born in New Mexico. And growing up, when I was small, you know, we went back to Newfoundland to see my mom's parents occasionally. And then dad was still in the military and he got stationed there a number of times because the Americans had a number of bases in Newfoundland, both Air Force bases and Navy bases during the Second World War that were created. And so he was stationed there a number of times in the 50s and 60s. I was there. My earliest memories are of Newfoundland as a child.
Wow.
Living at my grandfather's house. And my grandfather, he was in the Newfoundland Constabulary. He eventually became the detective chief inspector for St. John's, which is the largest city in Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. But he was also a great hunter. He loved to hunt, and he also was a fur trader on the side. So he sort of had a lot of interest in nature, as did my dad, because that's a fabulous place for fishing and hunting and those things. In fact, when he retired, we moved back to Newfoundland. And so I went back there as a teenager, and seabirds are a big part of the culture there, are still hunted. They used to be, at one time, Newfoundlanders, where they hunted all seabirds. It was for food. It wasn't for sport. It was subsistence.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I learned about seabirds, I learned from my grandfather, because he grew up in this time. You know, they didn't have refrigeration until after the war. And so couldn't keep fresh meat very long. You have to salt it. And so birds were a big source of fresh meat. You could go out and harvest some birds and have a meal of, you know, non-salt beef or salt pork, which were the two big mainstays of food. On land, they have a low diversity of species and game birds. But at sea, there's just a huge selection of birds. Eventually, Newfoundland joined Canada in 1949. And then they didn't realize it, but at that point, they were now under the control of the Migratory Bird Convention Act.
Of course.
And they were told they couldn't shoot any seabirds anymore. And that caused almost riots, especially with regard to the murre. the common myrrh and the thick-billed myrrh, which were two birds that are very abundant in Newfoundland in summer and winter. And that was the main bird that was harvested. So they actually made an exception for Newfoundland. It's the only non-native population left in North America that actually is allowed to hunt seabirds. And they harvest a 250,000 to, you know, 500,000 myrrhs every year for food. So this is what I grew up in. And seabirds were part of the lore and the dinner table. That was my first introduction. But I was fortunate enough to also develop a friendship with a person who was a bird watcher when I was a teenager there. And, you know, I got to start studying warblers and sparrows and all these things, which were, it took me a while to kind of get into that. But it turned out to be a lot of fun. And then one day he said, well, let's go out to the Seabird Islands. He had done some work for a guy who did research there. They wanted him to go back out and do some counts of some birds. I wanted to know if I wanted to go. So I went to the Witless Bay Islands in eastern Newfoundland, which are the largest puffin colony on the east coast of North America. And it's still the largest colony. There's you know, upwards of 500,000 puffins that live on those three islands there off the coast. So this is a massive seabird colony. And I had no idea what that would be like. And for those of you who have ever been to a seabird colony, you know, but if you've never been to one, it's kind of hard to imagine. You know, it's a Serengeti experience. I went and there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of birds flying around, and they're calling and they're burrowing underneath you, and they're flying through the air, and they're, you know, they're squawking and fighting and carrying food. And I mean, it's just, it's life, and it's vibrant, and it's noisy, and it's smelly. It's completely overwhelming, and it's awe-inspiring. And then at nighttime, you know, all of this quiets down, and then the storm petrels come in. There are these tiny little, you know, birds that are feed on plankton, but they only come back at night because they're so small. If they came back in the daytime, the gulls would eat them. And so they come in at night only. And there's a million of those on the island. And they
That's mind-boggling. Population size.
It is, yeah. And you walk around at night through the forest, through the turfy, burrowy slopes, and there's storm petrels, and they're banging into trees, and they're banging into your head, and they're banging, they're landing, and they're calling, and they're underneath the ground, and they're over your head. And that goes on all night long. And then it finally quiets down, and then the sun rises, and it's back to daytime puffins and razorbills and myrrhs and, you know, gulls and whatever. So I got hooked.
So are they all nesting in more or less the same area, or do they segregate the area by species?
It's segregated. Yeah, the island is the island is the puffins are they like the turfy slopes
because they burrow into the
because they burrow underground. The myrrhs like the cliffs, sheer cliffs, and some rocky outcroppings on the top of the cliffs because they kind of like the ledges, and they line up, you know, like side by side. They look a little bit like penguins standing upright. Razorbills, which are in between size, the razorbill auk, which looks a lot like the extinct great auk. It also breeds on rocky crevices and on the slopes and on the cliffs. And the kittiwake gulls that are very common there are also cliff breeders, but they like a different kind of cliff type than the myrrhs do. And the petrels are all underground in tiny little burrows in the forest. No, none of the other birds breed in the forest. All the seabirds are mostly on the slopes and the cliffs. But the petrels can go inland and fly through the forest and land. They dig in all the turfy ground in between all the trees.
Are all these birds competing for basically the same food, or are they specialists in terms of species of fish?
There's a lot of overlap. The petrels are definitely very different from the others. Petrels are amazing little birds because they'll fly 100, 200 kilometers away every day to go offshore to get away from the island, but also to feed out. They feed on the shelf edge and, you know, open ocean.
Really?
Feed on things like nyctophids, which are lantern fish that are small fish. Even as adults, they're fairly small. And they have little photophores, little lights that light up of them, you know, so they're actually what they call mesopelagic or bathypelagic fish. They love to be really deep in the water column, and they come up at nighttime more close to the surface, and in some cases they actually come right to the surface. The petrels are adapted to go out and get those at night, and they'll be feeding out there, and they'll feed on those nyctophids, and then for quite a long time, and they convert you know, they don't bring back fish to their young. They bring back oil. And sometimes there'll be mush of fish in it. But they regurgitate to their chicks in almost a pure golden oil. It's like the ultimate sort of food for a growing baby.
Well, in the classic, I think probably everybody who has seen a picture of a puffin has seen the fish lined up in the bill.
Yeah.
And then I understand the puffin, the adult puffin, feeds itself while out diving for fish. So everything it's bringing back for its chicks. Is that right?
Yeah, they feed offshore. And so the other species you're asking about what they eat, well, the murres and the puffins and the razorbills and the gulls, they're eating mostly capelin in Newfoundland. Capelin is a small marine smelt, and we have them here in Puget Sound, and not very many here. They'd be pretty scarce, but they like cold water. In the Gulf of Alaska, there's lots of capelin. It's a marine smelt that spawns near shore. But they also eat sand eels, sand lance, which is common around here. And they'll eat juvenile pollock or cod, just the what they call the 0H class. It's like it's the ones that were hatched in February, March, and then they grow. And by the time June, July, August comes along, they're just the right size for
just a couple of inches. Or so.
Yeah. Sometimes they eat some real small ones of those, and you'll see pictures of them. Sometimes they might have 20 or 30 or 50 or 60 lined up, and they can carry a lot. So puffins are pretty versatile. Murres only bring back one fish to their chicks. And usually it's usually a very rich one. It's got lots of energy. Puffins, you know, they can compensate. And if it's a small fish, they can get a bunch of them and bring them back. And if it's one that doesn't have a lot of energy, they can bring more.
How do they get them lined up in their beaks? The pictures I've seen, they all seem to be pointed the same way and all just kind of nicely lined up. How do they do that?
They have very dexterous beaks and very dexterous tongue. One of the things about their bill is when you look at a picture of a puffin, any species of puffin, you'll notice that there's this sort of an area right at the base of the gape of the mouth of the beak, you know, as it comes back, you know, comes back to a joint, it's jointed here, of course. So right back in the far corners, you'll see in the puffins, you'll see a little orange sort of rosette of tissue that surrounds that little bit of the corner of the mouth, right? And that area of the mouth, the jaw can actually kind of come apart. It's not like it's a joint that only opens a limited amount.
It's open, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not just like a pair of pliers just only opens up in a V shape. It actually opens up at the base as well. So it's possible to catch a fish and tuck it in the back corner with your tongue. Hmm. You don't want to pry it too hard because you'll cut the head off.
Yeah.
Once you close it, it's
tight and yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what would happen to the fish, except that the mouth opens at the base too. So you can kind of tuck a fish in there. And you can still open your beak at the front and catch another one. And then you can keep catching.
Oh, interesting.
But they are very flexible in the middle and the sides, you know, of the beaks are actually quite flexible. So they can, you know, they flex, they get fish, they tuck one in, they tuck them in both sides and they can catch. It's like they can hold that down and the front of the bill can still open and then they catch another one. And then,
I mean, that's a fascinating adaptation. To get a bunch of food to take back to your chicks while you're out fishing far from your burrow. That's pretty interesting.
We really don't give them enough credit. But somebody was studying murres where they only bring back one fish. But the principle's the same. And they had dive depth recorders on the murres. And so they could record exactly when they were fishing. And they also were looking at diets. And they were looking at what the birds were bringing back versus what they were eating themselves. I think they were doing a lavage thing where they could get the adults to throw up what they were eating. Bottom line was that the adults would go out and feed on juvenile pollock, which is a lean cuisine. You know, it's a white fish. It's not fatty. It's got some fat, but it's pretty lean, really. And you get 3 or 4 kilojoules per gram of energy from that. But a capelin or a sand lance could have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kilojoules per gram. You know, so a lot oilier, a lot richer.
Yeah, I think of them as being oilier fish. Yeah.
The adults themselves will eat juvenile pollock and fill their stomachs, and that's what they'll gorge on. And then just before they head back to the colony, they'll grab a capelin and they'll carry that back for the chick.
Interesting. And, you know,
it's not an accident. It's not coincidental. It's
It's smart. A finely tuned adaptation.
Finely tuned adaptation. And puffins will do the same thing. They bring back the richest food they can find. Puffins, you see these beautiful pictures of them. Sometimes little fish, but lots of times you see these big fish hanging from their mouths, like big old fat sand lance, you know, or a big fat capelin or smelts. And, you know, this is in herring, you know, the prime energy food. But they themselves may gorge on krill and euphausids. Mm-hmm. You know, small crustaceans, or some of the less energetically, like juvenile pollock. You know, they'll feed on pollock themselves.
That's interesting.
So they know, and they'll bring back the richest food they can for their kid.
So I know there's a different species on the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast, and we have the tufted puffins out here. Are they fulfilling basically the same niche on each side of the continent, or are there significant functional or ecosystem differences between the two species?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, a lot of what the birds can feed on is a function of body size. And the Atlantic puffin is a relatively small puffin compared to the Pacific ones. But there's a wide range in the size of Pacific puffins as well. And the adults, within the adults, like within the tufted puffin, there's quite a difference along gender lines as well. So there's a lot of variability in size that accounts for some differences in diet. But in terms of sort of niche, you know, the Atlantic puffin is very similar to our horned puffin. We see here breeding is tufted puffin. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, we do get a horned puffin showing up here. They don't breed here, but they do show up. They breed in you know, down Southeast Alaska. I think there might be a few in BC. I don't think we have any. I'm pretty sure we don't have horned here, but people do see them once in a while. And so that's the more classical puffin. It's got the yellow, and the horned puffin looks a lot like the Atlantic puffin. Mm. It's got a color, yellow and red colored bill and with stripes. And the Atlantic puffin has red and some yellow and a little bit of blue at the base, dark blue. And these two, they look, you know, very similar, their morphology, otherwise their head. They feed on similar kinds of fish. Tufted puffins, on the other hand, they eat an amazing variety of food. I think we found that there was over 100 different species that they ate that we had tallied.
Wow. You know,
that was with thousands and tens of thousands of prey to look at. There's no way that horned puffins and Atlantic puffins eat that variety. I mean, the list of species is enormous, but it's still dominated by a few. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. I mean, if there's sand lance to be had, everybody will eat sand lance.
Yeah.
You know, but if they're not, then tufted puffins will eat juvenile pollock, or they'll eat smelts, or they'll eat eel pouts, or they'll eat krill or squid. Mm. They love squid. In the wintertime, they eat mostly squid.
So when you use the term forage fish, does that just apply to the broad scope of species that are food?
Well, and sometimes it turns out that way. So when I say we'll talk about what the kinds of forage fish that birds eat and in my presentation next week, but there's always these other prey as well. And it gets a little complicated to say, well, they eat a wide variety of forage fish, but they'll eat copepods even. Copepods and various euphausids and a variety of squid species. And
that's pretty amazing. I mean, they're fairly small.
Nereidus worms.
Yeah.
All kinds of things, and which is one of the reasons why the tufted puffin is so successful.
I do want to pick up that point for a minute and ask you about the sort of the conservation status of the tufted puffins, and are there various threats that they're facing, or, you know, what's the status of their population?
Well, the status varies by geography. In Washington, they're declining.
Oh, really?
Yes, and tufted puffins are declining in Washington, Oregon, and California, and to some degree in British Columbia, increasing throughout much of their range in Alaska.
And what's the theory about the reasons for that?
It's not clear why this should be true. I mean, why it's complicated. But one of the times I was doing a sabbatical here, it was during a time period when people were looking at the effects of the regime shift. That was something that happened in the 70s and the early 80s. And the ocean climate in the North Pacific changed. And it's a cycle that's related to the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. So on a decade-based timescale, right, the waters oscillate between warm and cold. That's sort of a general statement.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a string of warm years with a really cold one.
Yeah.
But there's a period of decades where it's warmer than average, usually, but you get some cold years. And then it shifts to a period of colder than average for many years, although you can get a El Nino event that makes it warm.
Mm-hmm. So no simple answer is what you're telling me.
One thing is, I believe that it's a good example of how it's showing how the birds themselves are good indicators.
Hmm.
When you see patterns, especially large scale patterns like this, and you could say, well, maybe there, I mean, what's the cause? You ask, what's the cause of a decline? Well, it could be a change in the whole ecosystem.
Yeah.
And that's what this indicates. There mm-hmm. is differences between California, Oregon, and Washington. Yeah. And so we ought not to expect that with the trends in Alaska are indicative of what's happening here. And we ought not to be complacent mm-hmm. when they're declining here and just say, oh, it's just a phase. Well, mm-hmm. it could be there's other things. It could be they're getting caught in fishing nets. It could be that there's disturbance at their colonies that are driving them away. It could be that that oil, you know, pollutants and things may be affecting them at sea. It could be happening else, just like out in the middle of nowhere, because puffins, tufted puffins in particular, they tend to go way offshore.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the ones from Alaska, they just leave Alaska, the whole continental shelf, and they move down to North Central Pacific. Like they're out there in the North Central Pacific, halfway to Hawaii.
Interesting.
That's where they winter. And the puffins from here also move offshore out into the open ocean. And they may go further south down to off California, but they go off the shelf. And so they're in that's a whole nother ecosystem.
Right, which is whole nother bunch of factors.
Whole nother bunch of issues. So we've talked about the Atlantic puffin and the tufted puffin and the horned puffin. But the fourth species of puffin is the rhinoceros puffin.
Now, is that the same thing that I would know maybe as a rhinoceros auklet?
Yes, correct. But I like to call it by what it is, which is it's a puffin.
Interesting. Okay.
And if you look at it closely, you'll see why. It's a big, bulky bird. It carries fish in its bill.
Yeah.
It burrows in the ground, but it's nocturnal.
Well, I'm sort of glad to know that because I actually do notice the rhinoceros auklets, which I will now think about as the rhinoceros puffins. Thank you so much, John.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you.
I'm happy to talk about this stuff anytime. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks a bunch. Well, John Pyatt is an absolutely fascinating person to talk to. I mean, we got going on puffins and clearly ran out of time. So we will have part two of our puffin conversation, and we will have another conversation about bigger scale things like climate change. And I want to encourage everybody to attend Dr. Pyatt's lecture on this coming Sunday. That's Sunday, March the 14th, 3:00. It's part of the Port Townsend Science Center's Future of the Ocean series. The lecture is by Zoom, and you do need to register to get details. So go to the Port Townsend Marine Science Center website, and you can register for tickets to this free event. And then in addition, John is doing a sort of a deep dive science cafe type of conversation with folks on Monday, March the 15th at 6:30. And you can find out more about that on the Marine Science Center website as well. And that's ptmsc.org. And then there's one more upcoming event that I want to bring your attention to. And that's on Thursday, March the 18th, from 9 to 10:30. The Jefferson Land Trust is hosting a virtual and BYO conservation breakfast. This event celebrates the Quimper Wildlife Corridor. Of course, the Wildlife Corridor is home to Cappy's Trails and hundreds of species of plants and wildlife. This year marks 25 years of community action to protect the wild green corridor that stretches from Port Townsend all the way from Fort Worden across to Middle Point that we call the Quimper Wildlife Corridor. The Conservation Breakfast will explore how far we've come on this community-driven protection story and outline a bold new vision for the future protection. And for part of the event, I'll be the host for a number of conversations with special guest historians, naturalists, urban planners, health practitioners, community builders, longtime advocates, and including, for example, Reverend Kate Lohr, the minister of the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, Chloe Lampert, who is a fascinating teen naturalist. She's a high school student who is just this amazing naturalist and peer educator. Jeff Hammerson, who's a frequent guest here on Nature Now, will be there. Wendy Feltham, photographer and naturalist, and Brent Butler, who is currently works for the city of Seattle, but he's a former Port Townsend city councilor, a Jefferson County planner, an urban planner. Anyway, we will have lots of really fun discussions. So go to the Jefferson Land Trust website for details on how to register for this free event. Now we need to listen to this week's mystery sound. That was the low growl of an adult tufted puffin and the higher registered call of the tufted puffin chick, begging for food, no doubt. In our area, there are breeding colonies on Protection Island and Smith Island, and the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and Puget Sound Express offer evening puffin cruises during June and July. I do know that they are planning to offer socially distanced and masked cruises this coming summer. I do want to thank the Cornell Ornithology Lab and their All About Birds website for that recording. And then note that we have come to the end of this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed it. You can listen to podcasts of it and podcasts of other programs at the KPTZ website. I want to thank you a lot for listening.